Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
This is Ben Goujon with Quad City Arts, and welcome back to Talking Art, supported by Quad City Bank and Trust. Today, I am talking art with veteran arts journalist, author, and pianist Jonathan Turner. Jonathan, welcome to Talking Art. So
Hi.
Great to have you
Thanks,
here.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, for those who don't know Jonathan is what I like to call an unrelenting champion of the arts here in the Quad Cities. You may know him from reviews or from playing in pits in all sorts of different musicals around town, or his piano career, or as an author. He's done so many things. And I think of you as such a great voice for the arts and a supporter and a champion and really pushing people to engage in the arts. Jonathan, why are arts so important for you?
Oh, thank you. I've been a musician forever. I've played piano for decades now, and it's just such an integral part of my life. I think music and the arts are so crucial to people's personal lives as a sense of comfort, as inspiration, as a means of expression. You don't have to be able to play or to compose. Arts and organizations always need appreciative audiences, but luckily I've been able to play, to express myself on the piano through music, through songs and musicals, and so I have an extra appreciation. I actually had written something for Visit Quad Cities, their next destination guide in 2025, where I talk about the importance of the arts and their key to a sense of space and feeling connected. Music connects people in the community. When you're at a performance and you're sharing that with friends and strangers, that's such a unforgettable experience. It, you know, boosts the local economy. It helps with tourism. It helps attract residents and businesses to any community. And it really helps to define a community and makes it a place where people want to be.
Yeah, we've talked so much about that at Quad City Arts, just the importance of placemaking and making the Quad Cities a place that has a rich cultural life that people
For sure.
want to come to from outside. It makes the people who live there just kind of feel, and you mentioned the, you know, the economic impact of that. You know, we did that AEP 6 study with
right.
Americans for the Arts a couple years ago, and seeing the amount of dollars that arts and arts related events bring into the local economy, it's just incredible.
I know. It's the amenities. People want to live in a community like this that has such a vibrant, varied art scene, and the businesses and developers and people who want to locate look for that in a community.
Yeah. Well, you have been a longtime reviewer of the arts in the community as well, in many different places. And of everything you saw in 2024, what was your favorite thing?
Oh my gosh, it's so hard to pick one, but I've always been such a supporter of the Quad City Symphony, and they're such an amazing organization. They featured one of their really special gala concerts this past spring, and as a pianist, I was such a and am such an admirer of Emmanuel Ax. He's a legendary pianist.
Yeah.
He came to perform two kind of iconic concertos with Quad City Symphony, and that was just an unforgettable, beautiful experience.
Yeah, and what are you looking forward to next year?
Oh my gosh, in 2025, probably again with the Symphony. The Symphony is doing a really special program in February, early February, with Michael Abel's Pulitzer Prize-winning Omar's Journey, an adaptation of his Pulitzer-winning opera.
All right, Jonathan, I'm so glad you mentioned Omar's Journey, because that's on my top five list too.
Right.
I was listening to a bunch of the tracks from it yesterday, and it's so incredible.
I still haven't heard any excerpts from it. Yeah.
It's so incredible. There's not a recording of it, but Rihanna Giddens, who was one of the writers, has put out some of her own recordings that she produced.
Right.
Julie's aria is one of them. But for those who don't know, it was written in 2022. So it is a very new American opera focusing on a person who was basically stolen from Lebanon or
West Africa. West Africa, I think around 1807, was enslaved, brought to South Carolina. And the actual opera, Omar, actually premiered at Spoleto in Charleston, South Carolina, I think in 22.
Yeah.
And won the Pulitzer Prize in Music in 23.
Yep, and it's just an incredible piece. And the orchestra's doing a concert version of
adaptation,
it called Omar's Journey. And so that was also number one on my list. So, well, what else? What else are you looking forward to in 2025?
For 25? Some warmer weather, hopefully.
Yeah.
I think I'm a big supporter of Music Guild, and their shows are amazing. And in addition to, from my own personal experience, I'm going to be playing piano again, luckily, for their spring show is Escape to Margaritaville at Music Guild. And that's, if people don't know, a Jimmy Buffett kind of jukebox musical that Circa 21 did within the past couple years. Music Guild is also doing what many consider, the iconic kind of best musical in history, Gypsy, which is kind of a Mount Everest role for the lead, Mama Rose, whoever gets to play that part. And I think that's August 25.
It is. That is on my list, too.
Right.
Gypsy is so good. It's so good. And you talked about Mama Rose and, all the great actresses.
There have been so many revivals, and now Audra McDonald is actually the first black Mama Rose on Broadway, and she doesn't have enough Tonys, so she'll probably have to add a seventh Tony for that. Also, as a piano player, I'm looking forward to the symphony bringing the amazing Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue.
Yes.
Actually, the Rhapsody in Blue has celebrated its 100th anniversary this year. It premiered in February 1924. And the QCSO is bringing it as part of its 24-25 season. But we have to wait. I think it's in April of 25. And I got to be part of a Gershwin birthday celebration that Sound Conservatory in Moline did. If anyone hasn't been, Sound Conservatory really is an amazing, call it multidisciplinary. It's a music school, has 370 students. It's a retail store. It brings several performances to downtown Moline. It renovated the former library in 1903, Carnegie Library. So occasionally I've written that we have a new Carnegie Hall in Moline. And Andre, the owner there, is such a passionate supporter. I mean, he's a Juilliard-trained pianist, and he's an amazing supporter of music and the arts. And he actually, for this late September, the Gershwin birthday celebration, he had mid-September, he had a sold-out performance that featured many different performers, including the Corey Kendrick Trio, which was amazing. And I can't play jazz. I've played piano forever, but I can't play jazz like that. Can't improvise like that. That takes a special talent. And then Andre himself did a solo version of Rhapsody in Blue, where, he's really just the piano soloist and the orchestra all in one. I studied the Rhapsody in high school, and I mean, I wasn't the most dedicated, person to practice. I, tried to get in like an hour a day, but I wasn't the one who's going to practice 4 or 5 hours a day to become a concert pianist. But I've been able to still play over the years. And in the Rhapsody, if you don't know it, the Rhapsody in Blue has just certain sections that are just so technically difficult. I could never master them. And to do it as one man solo like that was just mind boggling. And he had a second encore performance for that concert where he asked me to play for a guest, like one of the guests the first time couldn't do it the second time. So I got to play, excuse me, for that concert, just one piece. I picked my favorite Gershwin song. It's called Our Love Is Here to Stay. Yeah. And that was the last. That's such a great song. And it was special to me. I actually had performed it at my mom's funeral in 2016. She was a big Gershwin fan. And it was actually the last song Gershwin wrote before his untimely death. In 1937, he died from a brain tumor at 38. And he actually, I found this out where he wrote the music to this. He wrote the music. He passed away, and then his brother, Ira, who was a lyricist, amazing lyricist that he wrote all his songs with, and his brother wrote the words after his death.
Yeah, I did not know that. And it's, Rhapsody in Blue is one of those pieces that it's very much ingrained in our culture. Some of those phrases and sections of it. But I had never heard it performed live. And then when Baron Ryan was here, I think it was in 2022. He and his father played a duet.
Really?
And something about hearing that piece live just, it hits in a different way. And it's like, I know the recording. I can listen to the recording. But seeing that piece performed live, it's just so powerful. And
it's eternally, Andre talked about this at the concert. Gershwin was only 25 when he wrote it.
Wow.
Which is, he was famous for writing songs and musicals up to that point.
Yeah.
I mean, he had such a brief, blazing career, like only about 15, a 15-year musical career. It was commissioned by Paul Whiteman, who had a long association with Big Spiderbeck, if people don't know. And he was asked to write it in 3 weeks. And he basically, to come up with that, it's groundbreaking because it was like a fusion of jazz and classical and, bring this new kind of it's such a vital, youthful, energetic, beautiful piece. And it shook up the concert world. And I think at the first performance in New York, Gershwin, he had it orchestrated by Farida Groff. It was a person who wrote the orchestra part.
Yeah.
But Gershwin basically improvised. He just played the piano part, from memory. And then he actually went on tour. I did a few years ago when I wrote for the newspaper. I did another one of my career highlights was when Paul McCartney came to the Mark, performed in 2019. I kind of did a story of what other big names have performed in the Quad Cities over the years. Many, many people at the Mark, of course, but also the Call Ballroom
yeah.
since closed on the west side of Davenport. And
We're going to revive it.
We should. I know. Gershwin had done a tour of Rhapsody in Blue in 1924, and he actually performed that in May of 1924 at the Call.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
But to be, when I was 25, I don't think I did anything of note.
No. So I was just trying to eat and live on my own.
He was kind of the Mozart of his era. It's like Mozart wrote from when he was a child. But it's just, that's one of the things with music. I mean, people who are composers, the same thing with writing. I've written, for so many different outlets and forms, but I'm a nonfiction writer. And so I can't imagine being like a Stephen King, somebody who writes fiction. And it's similar to being a composer with your creativity, just to have that imagination. And there are only 12 notes in the octave scale. That's all you have to work with, and people keep churning out so much music over the years, and just to have that creativity, it's just, I'm in awe of those kind of people.
Yeah, well, and it's fascinating. Just I think about the math of music. Like you said, there's 12 notes, and granted, we have octaves of those notes, but the infinite possibilities and the way people continually come up with new ways to put sound and notes together to create new things, it's all and, obviously inspired by other things,
right.
But
and like I've written songs, I I've written there's a setting of the church service I play at Zion Lutheran Davenport, and I've written a setting of the church service, which was one of my favorite things I've done, but I've never written for orchestra. I've never written instrumental pieces. And so just to be an orchestrator, I'm, so impressed with Jacob Banks at Augustana, who's a prolific composer. And just that's another skill that I don't or I never learned, or it's just to be able to do that and write for all the colors of the orchestra, and that's just beyond me as well.
Yeah, well, tell me more about your career as a musician. You know, when I first met you, it was as a writer.
Right,
so
right.
So when I started seeing you playing around the community, it was kind of like, oh, I didn't know Jonathan did that too.
And hopefully, I mean, being a writer about music and the arts, I mean, I think that obviously helps.
Sure.
As a musician myself to understand what all these artists do and understand the training and the like the creativity I mentioned that goes into it. I started piano lessons just as a little kid at 5 and a half. I grew up in Milwaukee and I have two brothers and three of us started, you know, in different instruments. They started more on the Suzuki violin side and they never really stuck with an instrument, but I kept on, you know, taking lessons. I studied at a conservatory in Milwaukee through high school. I played for my first musical in high school way back in 1980 when I was a sophomore. And that was Carousel, which is one of the greatest musicals also ever written. And, you know, I just got hooked on musicals then. My junior year in high school, the drama director took like a sabbatical. He was off that year. I think there were two college students that came to direct. He chose Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle, which was like a really obscure.
Oh, wow.
If you're a Sondheim fan, you probably know, you know, that was a flop for Sondheim after his most successful show in the early 60s. And but it had such challenging music, but it has really beautiful music too. The title song is one that's been incorporated into a lot of cabaret acts, and Anyone Can Whistle is a great song. And but just to be able to play, there was that part, that score as well has music that's just so challenging. And Sondheim in general is kind of like also like the Mount Everest of musical theater, and he's just a genius. And so fast forward, you know, many years, I got to play for Sweeney Todd Music Guild in 2023. And that's another show that it's just so challenging, but so like rewarding. I mean, once you learn the music, I had known it before and I played for a PV high school production of it. And there's just so much. I mean, it's literally an opera. I mean, it's an opera for Broadway, and it's been done by opera companies. And it's just so challenging and just so satisfying to be able to, you know, and have that role as the accompanist where, you know, the cast is just like I'm just accompanying during the rehearsals, and the orchestra is coming in the last week or so to, and they had like the, I think it was the biggest production Music Guild's ever done. Cause there are like 30 some people on stage and they had a 25 piece orchestra. The orchestra had to be, the director extended the stage so it could be closer over the pit.
Sure.
And so they had the orchestra behind the set. And that was not as satisfying as a performer for me. That wasn't as satisfying because I had to just play a limited, you know, there's a lot of organ. There's that creepy organ prelude at the very beginning of Sweeney Todd. So that was fun. But you're only limited to what the book, you know, this is the organ book that you have to play. Just so there are a number of songs where it was the orchestra. And so I didn't get to play anything. And I'm like sitting there, I wish I was part of this, but so I've been able to accompany musicals and singers, and I wrote a musical that was done in 2010 at Playcrafters. That was a very long, like off and on 10-year process.
Yeah.
Based on the Book of Job, and it was one of the pastors at the church suggested it. And if you know the Book of Job, that's a very dramatic story, and obviously is very fitting for the stage, and I thought it ended up pretty well.
Well, I had no idea you had written a musical.
Right, right. And it's like, and that's another thing where, like, I mean, if Sondheim or any other composer, how do you do like a musical every 1 or 2 years? And because it like took everything out of me just to do the one. Well, like I said, it was a long process. And the pastor, the former pastor, wrote most of the lyrics. He wrote the book and most of the lyrics. And so as a composer, it was easy. It's easier for me. People always say, what comes first, music or lyrics? And it's easier if you have lyrics already set or an idea. Here's the text, and I can just set the music or be inspired to write music to that text. And so, and there were a couple of the songs where I just wrote the lyrics myself. And like, also, you know, I've been able to write a few wedding songs. My wife and I, when we got married, we wrote a song that was performed at our wedding. And then two brothers of mine, a number of years later, my two brothers, when they got married, I wrote songs for their weddings. And then that was really special.
That is really special. I love that. Well, it makes me, you know, you saying about the process of writing, that was one thing that really jumped out to me. And I don't know if you saw the film version of Tick, Tick, Boom.
Oh, yeah, the Jonathan Larson. Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, you know, he was amazing in that.
I know, right.
But, you know, the whole film spends leading up to him producing this
Before
musical.
Rent.
And you
right,
kind
I
of
know.
You kind of think that, like, oh, this is leading up to Rent. And then he does it, and no one invests. And he has the conversation with his agent. And he's like, what do I do now? And she says, you write the next one, and then you write the next one, and then you write the next one.
And because
it will happen.
After,
you know, we invest so much in, I'm going to do this one project.
Because after my show at Playcrafters, I can't imagine saying like, oh, what's your next project? I'm going to work on, I mean, I should be able to, you know, work with somebody else on another, but I can't imagine it's such a forbidding, I mean, like any author, any like book, especially with fiction, but it's so like, it's so pressure. Yeah. Like it's just,
yeah. Well, you're investing.
How do you come up with your next project like that? But for nonfiction, I mean, my journalism career and my, you know, with the two nonfiction books I wrote, and that to me is so relatively easy because I mean, because part of being a good reporter and writer is listening. I love I love talking to people, just hearing their stories and then, you know, communicating. I'm kind of the conduit and getting their story out to the world. And so, and but it's more pressure in a way because you have to like be accurate and make sure you're telling everything truthfully where, you know, in fiction, you can just make up everything. But,
right.
I'm so prolific as a writer because I just love writing, getting information, telling the stories. I drove up this morning, I wrote for QuadCities.com during the pandemic 2020 and 21. And I did this Saturday. I did a weekly feature called Saturday in the Arts. And so there once a week, I took a topic or a person or a organization, did an in-depth feature that, you know, ran thousands of words. And to me, that wasn't really difficult because I just, people give me a hard time because I write too long because I wrote for newspapers and my editors would always give me a hard time. You need to cut this. We can't use all this.
Right.
And so I preferred the online format where if you're just writing online, there's no space limit.
No.
And I just think if people are interested in a topic or want to know about Jonathan Larson or Sondheim or whatever, they're going to take the time because people read Harry Potter book. You know how big Harry Potter works and how popular Harry Potter books have been.
Yeah.
Those are freaking huge,
long
books. People don't seem to have any trouble, you know, devouring those. And so you can take time to read, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 words on. I wrote for the last inauguration when Biden was inaugurated in 21. I did a long feature on getting back to the importance of the arts. If search Biden inauguration QuadCities.com with my name, and I did this long feature on just the importance of the arts on a national level. Because after the first Trump administration, when Trump was president, he. You know, he's so divisive as a personality anyway, but he never attended Kennedy Center Honors.
Right.
For whatever political reasons, you know, he's not with the in, he's not a, you know, artists are not a fan of his. So he didn't want to support them, I guess. But when you look at Obama and then the Biden administration, especially the Biden inauguration, it was during COVID, obviously, where people, they had an amazing, you know, Springsteen and all these amazing artists performed leading up to the inauguration, and they had the Amanda Gorman poem that was read during the inauguration. And so I just talked about how arts unify, bring people bring people together. I mean, it's such a divided country. And, you know, people say music is universal language. So people can get so much inspiration, like I said, comfort, and just to have that form of expression and to be impressed by it and to learn from it and to see how people express themselves through music and the arts. And the, when the Kennedy Center first opened, I think in 1971, Richard Nixon obviously was president, and I quoted, you know, what Nixon said at the premiere of Kennedy Center. And it's like, can you imagine Donald Trump saying like that? You never heard anything from him about the importance of the arts. And yeah, he wanted, and probably still does, wants to, you know, eliminate the NEA or the NEH, or eliminate, you know, public support of the arts.
Yeah.
And just crazy, because especially after the pandemic, so many arts organizations and venues are still trying to recover, still trying to get audiences back. And in the age of streaming, and I'm so guilty of this too, because me and my wife stream a lot of shows and things at home, you know, you get all that content that was so it's so important during COVID. People are stuck at home. What do? They look for music, movies, shows. They needed distraction, first of all, but you see the importance of the arts during that time of crisis. But coming back from after the pandemic, you know, you see the importance of communal gathering, you know, at concerts or movies. There's no substitute for seeing a great concert, great movie together with people.
Yeah.
You're sharing that experience, especially live theater. It's different with movies because movies are unchanging, but you're at a live show, you know, anything can happen in theater, as you know. And so I actually saw, this was at Black Box Theater, I think 23 maybe. And it was a production of Hello Dolly. They did a, you know, kind of a shortened or a abridged version with a smaller cast and Hello Dolly. And they had a, like Circa does, they use tracks, musical tracks that are pre-recorded. And there was a little brief section of the show where the tracks just cut out, no accompaniment. And Shelley Cooper played Dolly, another great role. And the show must go on. They just kept going. And that's just something that, you know, you can't, like, replace. That's something different can happen every performance. But just I remember, you know, when the movie A Quiet Place premiered.
Yeah.
I went with my son, 2018, I think it was. And it was the quietest I've ever, you know, seen a theater. Like, it was a packed theater, and everybody's just on the edge of their seats and not making a sound and just being able to absorb that, or like the scares. And when something happens, everybody like reacts as a group, and just that's such a thrill.
Well, there's something in a movie that, like, you can watch a movie at home and it's funny or it's scary, but there is, even though the movie is unchanging, there's something about being in that group. And it's so interesting to me, because there's a lot of, you know, just talk about how we've lost sense of community as a society. But arts are such a great way to foster that, you know, going to see a play or a concert or a film rather than sitting at home and streaming it.
And it doesn't matter what your politics are.
No.
Everybody has a heart. Everybody has a soul. Everybody has human emotions, where arts tap into those emotions, express things that you personally aren't able to express. And you can identify with whatever character, whether it's, you know, Taylor Swift or whoever the artist is. She's, you know, that's how I feel. You know, it doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat, or Libertarian, or,
no,
you know, this is something, like you said, binds you together.
Yeah.
It shows, I mean, that's what the country really needs, that commonality to show everybody has these feelings, everybody has these frustrations and joys, and we don't need to pit each other against each other, because this is what we have in common. And that's like what I said in the QuadCities.com piece, we're the United States of America. We need to be united, and we can do great things better and only if we do them together.
Yeah, well, and I'm going to slaughter this quote probably, but if you ever go to a show at Center for the Living Arts, our daughters are involved there, and Dino Hayes leads off every show with a quote. And I'm not sure where the quote is from, but it's, you can tell a person a fact and they'll know. You can tell a person a truth and they may believe you. But by God, tell them a story and it'll live in your heart forever.
Wow.
You know, right. And that's what the arts are. They're stories, whether it's music or theater or film or whatever. Yeah. It's storytelling, and it goes back to our primal days of sitting around a campfire and telling the story of the day's hunt. Like, those stories bind us.
Right.
And like you said, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on or, you know, because we're all human and we can relate to feelings, and you may not be able to express them all the time, but you can see it in a film or hear it in a symphony and go, that's it. That's I know that.
And one of the biggest frustrations for me, like as a journalist, you know, people refer to the post-truth era, like facts and truth shouldn't be something you want to believe or not. I mean, they're the facts, and don't get me started on that.
I won't. Well, why don't we get back and talk about, you know, we talked about a lot of the things that we're looking forward to next year. A couple other things I wanted to throw in that I'm really excited about is Hadestown at the Adler. That had opened
I forgot. Yeah, that's right.
That had opened in New York right before I left the city, and I did not get a chance to see it. So the music's great. I'm so excited to see it.
And that was Rachel Chapkin directed?
Yes.
Right, originally on Broadway. I remember when I was with the Times, I did a story on two Broadway people that had Quad Cities connections.
Yes,
Rachel,
she does.
I forget her husband's name. Her husband is from Davenport.
Yep. Yep, they have Quad City ties, and that show's going to be great. It's at the Adler in January.
Yeah, one other, if I could mention, one of my favorite experiences at the Adler in the past year also was the touring production of Chicago, which is one of my favorite musicals.
Yeah.
And I got to play for Chicago with PV at a, you know, International Thespian Festival. John Kander, I have a special, you know, affinity for John Kander as a composer. He's kind of a contemporary of Sondheim, but now I think he's like 97 now. He's like getting up to Dick Van Dyke longevity. But
I hope Dick Van Dyke never dies.
He's
if anyone lives forever, it's
99.
Dick Van Dyke.
And he graduated from Oberlin College, which was my alma mater. Chicago is such great music and such an amazing show. And I was going to say, I'm so happy that the revival, I mean, it revived on Broadway in 1997, still playing, longest running American Broadway musical in history. I think it's only like second to Phantom of the Opera in terms of longest.
Yeah.
And it like lost all the Tonys the year it premiered, I think in 75, lost all the Tonys to A Chorus Line because happened to be Chorus Line came out the same year. But now it's far eclipsed Chorus Line on Broadway. But I saw the touring production at the Adler was, you can tell, you know, the quality. I mean, this was literally a Broadway caliber production, and just the lights and the acting and the music and everything was so just stratospherically, you know, talented. And they had, I don't know if it's written like this, but they had the band, the orchestra on stage. I don't know if they do this, must do this in a Broadway production. So they have the lead performers, the Rosie and the lead performers like are interacting with the conductor.
Yes.
And, but anyway.
Roxy and Velma.
Roxy and Velma. And so Circa 21 has wanted to do Chicago for years, and they're finally able to bring it for this coming season.
Yeah.
I forget what date, 2025. I haven't been to Circa in a while, but Chicago at Circa, they do longer runs, obviously 6 or 7 weeks. And that's what I'm really looking forward to as well.
Yeah. There's also rumors. I don't know if there's any that there may be a production of Fun Home happening in the Quad Cities, which would be super exciting for me. That was if you don't know it,
I know of it. I don't really.
Yeah, it was based on a graphic novel by Alison Bechdel about her process of coming out as a lesbian, and her father was a closeted gay man, but it takes place kind of when she's an established adult writer, when she's a 10-year-old girl, and when she's in college, and kind of weaves back and forth through all of these and her relationship with her father through it all. And I got to see it when it was on Broadway, and it was just incredible. Michael Cerveris, who played Sweeney and Sweeney Todd in the that production of Sweeney that had all the actors playing the instruments.
I know. I can't imagine that.
He played the father, Bruce, and it's just incredible. Just the most heartbreaking, beautiful little musical. So
yeah, another
I'm hoping that happens.
Another one that's coming to Circa that's also a relatively new production, Come From Away.
Yes.
Which is a beautiful, I haven't seen, but it's such an inspiring story of around 9/11, I think it was Newfoundland.
Yeah.
Set how this town in Newfoundland.
One of the flights was diverted and landed in Newfoundland.
All these passengers. And,
yep. Well, so that came through the Adler this year.
Was it
during
the Adler? Okay.
Yeah. I didn't get to see it there, but I think Circa is one of the first kind of regional theaters of its size to get the rights to it. So that's really exciting.
Sure.
What else am I excited about this year? Oh, public art. We've talked a lot about theater and music, but there's also lots of great public art.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the Quad Cities, one of the other writing activities. I'm currently doing occasional blog posts for Visit Quad Cities, and Dave Harrell and the whole Visit Quad Cities team have been such supporter of the arts as well, particularly public art.
Yeah.
And as Quad City Arts has been a champion many, many years for the public sculpture program, Metro Arts, the public murals, and I've written a lot about the value and the importance of public art, because obviously that's something, there's no cost and it's free to the public to enjoy.
Yeah,
it's indoors and outdoors. I've written a ton about Heidi Sallows, Sarah Robb, and Atlanta Dawn, three like powerhouse female artists, and all the just jaw-dropping amount of public art they brought. And Quad City Arts was obviously integral into renovation of Arts Alley, downtown Rock Island, right next to the Quad City Arts Center, downtown Rock Island. And those two murals, two women, Atlanta and Nicole Salger, I think, of Miami, did those. And that's another artistic vehicle, which I used to be able to draw. I did some art when I was in high school. But to do that large scale, those large scale murals on the side of buildings,
it's incredible. It's
just incomprehensible to me. And Atlanta, when I talk to Atlanta, I mean, she does the design. You know, any artist does the smaller designs. This is my concept. This is the design on a, 8.5 by 11 or 11.14. But then when she puts it on a wall, I don't know if every mural artist does this. She only does like visual cues. They're not like, they're not the initial drawings. They're like noodling.
Yeah, it's a doodle grid.
And how does that work even?
It's so, from what I have talked to Atlanta about, is she does this big doodle on there, and then rather than doing a formalized grid where you have to kind of like do each square,
it's more she knows where which part goes on that grid.
Yeah, she can use references on those doodles, and because it's not as straight and linear, it gives her more accuracy of, oh, I know this line on the 40-foot bird is going to hit this place on this little doodle. It's crazy. When I first saw her do it, it just blew my mind. And I was like, what are you doing? And then she explained the process to me. I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But it's a fascinating process to watch.
Right. And I just think, hopefully the Quad Cities is becoming more known for their embrace of public art, because that's one of the amenities that when you visit, we visit a city. I wrote about this in the Bucktown book, where Cal Carter of the Downtown Davenport Partnership said, downtowns help define a community. So people visit, they go into the downtown. You know, he said, if your downtown looks like a dump, you're going to assume the rest of the city is not worth looking at. So it's like you never get a second chance to make a good first impression. Yeah. So the first impression, to have all this colorful, vibrant, amazing quality. I mean, it's not you know, it's not graffiti. I know graffiti is an art and there's artists.
Yeah.
And we've, my wife and I visited Toronto like a year or so ago and there's so much, I mean, there's public art, but there's so much graffiti and it just didn't seem attractive to me. But to have that quality art in these public spaces, it's just, you know, this city must be cool. I mean, there's so much life and there, you know, sometimes it might be a vacant building. Sometimes it might, like downtown Moline, the humongous mural a year or so ago on the side of Analog on Fifth Avenue. You know, it draws people in. It literally is a magnet to bring people to those downtowns.
Yeah, and it's part of those place-making initiatives. Like, it makes downtowns places people want to be. When you can come and you're surrounded by that beauty and that art and just that intersection of ideas and color and vibrancy.
And Atlanta, life. And yeah, and other artists, I love how during the holidays, during this holiday time, all the window displays, I mean, I think it's Moline, it's been Moline, Rock Island, Davenport. I'm not sure if Bendorf's been part of it, but the downtown window displays, just to have those bring new life and just the holiday spirit, and it just lifts your mood.
Yeah. And it's just a way to support, you know, talking about arts advocacy and supporting local artists. You know, there are so many ways to do that. Whether it's attending a show or a performance or, you know, shopping from local artists for holiday gifts. You know, we've obviously got our gallery, but there's places like The Artery and so many local artists who are around.
Yeah, and I love what Quad City Arts does with art at the airport gallery.
Because
obviously so many people come through the airport, and just to have that rotating gallery and all those, you know, that outlet for so many artists. And getting back to the public art aspect, Atlanta has told me, you know, it's kind of like a composer or an architect or a builder. You're bringing something that's permanent that can hopefully last for years.
Yeah.
You know, she said, I want to bring my daughter, my kids here. You know, your mom did that.
Yeah. And
well, that's just amazing.
That's one thing I love so much about the Metro Arts program is how many grown adults that I've spoken to in the community who have said, yeah, I did Metro Arts. Like, and then they drive by that mural and say, hey, I helped make that, you know? Or I know Sarah Robb does these community art pieces where she'll kind of do like a paint by number somewhere, and then they get people from the community to come and fill it in. And gives people that sense of community we talked about earlier. Like, hey, we helped to make that. I was a part of that. So It's the arts, just they bring people together. And let's do it more.
I know. Right?
But one last question for you, Jonathan. If you had one wish for the Quad Cities art scene, what would it be?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, I've said there's so many, you know, affordable options. It's amazing how much there is to do in the Quad Cities and at affordable prices compared to a lot of places, bigger cities. Oh my gosh.
I can tell you what mine is if you want a little time.
Sure.
I would love to see some investment in some state-of-the-art amazing venues.
Like, you have one off the top of your head you're thinking of?
I mean, not the venue I want isn't here.
Right.
The venue
right.
I want isn't here. You know, I look at some venues in other places, or just kind of art centers in other places that are, you know, new and shiny and have amazing lighting, amazing acoustics, great seating. Like, I want that top of the line venue that could work for music and theater and dance and
right.
That's what I want.
There's so many talented writers and performers in the area. I mean, it'd be great for there's so many community theaters here. You know, I'd like to see more new work. I mean, I know it's so hard for theaters to attract audiences for plays and shows they don't know, they're not familiar with. Everybody likes to see the familiar. So for every gypsy and for every Chicago, And Quad City Arts did this with, you know, commissioning or Atlanta winning one of the Arts Alley murals, but either, you know, opening it up for local playwrights, local composers to commission more new works. Quad City Symphony has done a great job in terms of Jacob Banks and other composers have written new works for the symphony. But, and I want, you know, I'd like to see more collaboration like the Quad City Symphony and Ballet Quad Cities did their fall Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
And that, and John Hurdy and August Anna with the symphony have done great things in terms of doing these massive masterworks concerts that bring all these people together, like the Beethoven Nine, which was amazing. They did a few years ago. Both commissioning new works and bringing arts organizations together, partnering to bring, you know, these masterpieces to life.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I miss in the, at least in the theater scene, about like Mockingbird on Main. It was such a great incubator for local artists to have their work done. So I also wish that we have another space like that.
I miss the Mockingbird. And one of my highlights from 24 this past year, you probably saw To Kill a Mockingbird at Black Box.
Yeah.
Jim Driscoll and their amazing cast. I just, you know, around the anniversary of the building collapse that shut down Mockingbird in Davenport, they brought, you know, the namesake, you know, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird. They brought that back to Black Box Theater, and that was very special.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Jonathan. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being my guest. Thanks again to Quad City Bank and Trust for their support. And thanks to our producer, Mark. For more information on arts advocacy, you can visit quadcityarts.com. And for more information on Jonathan, check out his Facebook, his writings on the RC Reader, his book, A Brief History of Bucktown at Amazon.com, and his QC travel guide, www.100thingsqc.com. And remember to check him out on New Year's Eve at the Syndicate in downtown Moline. Thanks again, Jonathan, and thanks so much for joining us for Talking Art.